The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 5. How Mammals Get Their Colors.
How is it that dogs have so many fantastic coat colors? And what can we understand about the underlying genetics that gives us that amazing diversity of coat colors that you see in domestic dogs? Well, answer to the first question is they have fantastic coat colors because humans wanted it that way. Human breeders have been very, very strong in their opinions about what the diversity of dog coat colors ought to look like. And it's one of the reasons that dogs are such a good example for understanding the pathway for mammalian pigments. This applies to all mammals. It applies to humans, it applies to horses, it applies to cats. But why we're going to linger on dogs is it's because one of the places where humans have had the most extravagant ideas about what to tolerate and what to encourage as they bred dogs over and over again through thousands of years. By the way, humans are relatively boring for this pathway. We might look out at humans and say, oh my goodness, look at all the diversity, the different hair colors, the different skin colors, the different eye colors, all of which are part of this pathway, this very same pathway. But really, compared to dogs, we're just various shades of dark and light. We have almost no diversity at all. We're just a range from darker pigments to lighter pigments, and that's it. And in fact, when humans get any sorts of unusual variations in their melanin pigment pathway, which is what we're going to talk about, that tends to be called a syndrome or a condition. It doesn't usually tend to be talked about in the same way that we would talk about coat color in a dog. So the really fun examples are with dogs. A lot of this has also been worked out with mouse coat colors, both in the laboratory, deliberately for the purpose of understanding this pathway, but also among people who breed mice called fancy mice for shows and who really celebrate mammalian coat colors by coming up with all sorts of amazing colors of mice, too. So they're another wonderful example of this. Anything that I tell you about dog coat colors can be extrapolated to any of the other mammals. I will do some more specific material on cats because there are a couple of exceptional things that happen with cats. So don't worry, I'm not leaving cats out of this picture. For the most part, though, most of the things that I say about dogs will apply to cats. Wild animals, by the way, somewhat different story. They, too, are more conservative in the variability of their coat colors. You might find a pack of wolves in which there's a range of colors from lighter browns to darker browns and maybe more rusty browns. But like humans, wild animals tend to have a more limited range of pigments. What I'm talking about can be applied to understanding wild animal coat colors, but there just won't be as much material to talk about. There's just not as much of variability. So the first thing I want you to do is to recall the cookie factory. I promised that we would be recalling that to try to get into mind the complexity, the amazing complexity of a real genetic pathway. And now we're going to launch into the melanin-making pathway in mammals. Melanin is the pigment that gives colors of hair, eyes, and skin. Before we do that, I want to say that your goal is not to memorize this pathway, but rather to appreciate its intricacy, to see the possibilities for how it was analyzed. We won't do an actual analysis of the pathway. That would be too much, I think, for an audio tape, but you could see the possibilities for how you might analyze it. I want you to be intrigued by how connected this pathway is to other parts of the cells. I want you to get a little glimpse of the potential effects of environment on this pathway. This will be an opportunity for us to pull environment into the picture. And I would like you never to look at a dog or a cat or any other mammalian coat color the same way again. So, where to begin? And also where to end this? Remember, with the cookie factory, I said we're arbitrarily beginning here and we're arbitrarily ending there. Well, it's the same thing. We're arbitrarily beginning the melanin pathway at a particular place. And I am deliberately going to use 8 genes by the letters that they are typically used in the literature. Again, rather than saying I'm going to call my genes A, B, C, D, E, and F, I'm going to use the letters that are typically used in case you would like to go and look these up. And it will be a little easier for you to look them up if we actually use the real letters. Therefore, the 8 genes that we are going to be addressing, think of these as the 8 blueprints for 8 machines in a pathway, are, in approximate order of their appearance, E, K, A, C, B, D, M, and S. Okay? How are you going to remember all of those? Don't worry, I'm going to do lots of things throughout to keep us on track with what these are. Let's begin with gene E. Gene E, and remember, I'm trying to describe machines here. The machines are going to look a little bit like the cookie factory, but not quite. So what is gene E doing? Gene E is right outside of a cell called a melanocyte. That melanocyte is going to become filled with the pigment melanin of one sort or another, or not. Okay, it's got a number of choices, but the cell has the potential of being filled with this pigment melanin. We're starting right outside of the cell, and gene E makes a product that is stuck onto the outside of the cell, and what happens next is up to the next 2 genes. Okay, so far we've just got gene E with a product that is forming a structure that's attached to the outside of the cell. Gene K makes a product that, if it can, binds to E. Okay? If K does bind, then we will be on our way. Okay? The factory will be running pretty much in a normal sort of way. Okay? But there's a possibility. And here's maybe our very first branch. There is another product, the product of gene A. And some forms of gene A are going to prevent K from binding on to E. And if A prevents K from binding to E, then we will be on our way down a different route, and we will end up making a different sort of pigmentation. And I'm going to pause right there because that was an awful lot to hear. A's and K's and E's interacting, and I know you'd like to have a different way of thinking about this. It has a little bit of a Dr. Seuss or nursery rhyme-like quality to it. It's certainly not linear. It's not A makes B, and then B makes C, and then C makes D. It's far from it. And in fact, already we're at the very first juncture here, and we've got a set of complicated interactions. I'm going to do something here that I don't typically do if I have a chalkboard at the ready, but I don't, and I need a mnemonic aid for you. Let's say that A is a kid named Albert, and K is a kid named Kenny, and E stands for entrance. It's really 2 kids, Albert and Kenny, fighting over the entrance of the cell, fighting over the E for entrance. And I'm maintaining A, K, and E here again so that you can look these up. There are a lot of possibilities for what could happen. First of all, there may not be any E product for entrance. Maybe that's what's broken. Maybe there's nothing stuck to the outside of the cell. Maybe K will attach on to E, and A will not prevent it. Maybe Kenny will attach on to the entrance. Maybe Albert will not prevent it. Maybe Albert will win, and Kenny won't be able to attach on to that E for entrance. So we have a number of different possibilities. Another analogy here is it's very much like a soap opera. So as I go through this short list of possibilities, feel free to think soap opera. Feel free to think soap opera designed by Dr. Seuss. Okay, here are the short list of possible ways for these interactions. E might be non-functional, so K never gets to bind. K might be non-functional and unable to bind E, or both of them are non-functional. Or A might have stopped K from binding onto E. And notice that we've scarcely begun with the different combinations, and we already have a lot of options. So this is something to keep in mind. This is a typical genetic pathway, and this is what geneticists are up against. We're only at the very beginning here, and we've already have all of these possible options with all of these possible consequences, actually consequences that I still have to develop as we get further along in the pathway. Just inside of the cell, and let's say that K has successfully attached onto E so that we are inside of the cell, so we've successfully made it across the boundary and are inside the cell, is another gene product waiting for us, waiting for the go-ahead, and its name is C. And C has the possibility of triggering a multi-branching pathway. And we're only going to look at two of those branches to start with, and two is actually going to be quite a bit to look at. So we're now inside of the cell. Let's say that the argument between E, K, and A has been settled. We're inside of the cell. We're on our way. C, which is actually a fairly complicated set of genes, is doing a chemical reaction such that if it occurs, we are on our way to making the darkest version of melanin, called eumelanin. If we end up not having the strongest version or allele of C, then we may be on our way to making a paler version of melanin called pheomelanin. So C is at a real pivotal point here where we're either making a darker pigment or a lighter pigment. Now, let's say that we continue along toward the making of eumelanin, the darker pigment. Let's say that we have a strong version of C, and that machine is going full force, and we're heading down that particular fork in the pathway. Here we encounter the B genes. And by the way, those are the same B genes that we had in a previous lecture, the very same B genes. Here they are in their context. If we have big B, we will get full, rich, black eumelanin. That would be a completely black dog. If the version of B at that juncture is little b, we will get full, rich, brown-colored eumelanin. There's at least a couple of versions of eumelanin, so there's a full, rich, black and a full, rich, brown. Okay? But right next to B are the D genes, and it matters very much what version we have of those Ds. Those Ds, by the way, are modifiers. And recall the cookie factory. When I use that word modifier in that context, I said, these are the genes or these are the machines that are either adding the chocolate chips or not adding, or adding the frosting or not adding. So the D genes are modifiers. They're not doing anything terribly dramatic, but we are going to notice their results. If big D is present, that full rich color, whether it's dark brown or dark black, will be manifested. If we have little d, we're going to get diluted colors, smoky blacks or milky blacks or smoky browns or milky browns, also very nice colors. Nothing wrong with those colors. So dog breeders are very interested in those D genes as well as the B genes. Now, there was a completely different set of options beginning back with C. Remember, just inside of the cell, after A, K, and E have sorted out what they need to sort out, remember I said that there are different versions of C. Some of them are less efficient, and they send us down a different fork in the pathway, and we end up making a paler pigment. We actually never get to those B and D genes. So one pathway allows us to get to the B and D genes. We make the full rich colors, or we make the smoky versions of those. But the other pathway leads us to pheomelanin, which is a pale pigment, going to give us some of our yellows that we might get in a dog or tan colors that we might get in a dog. Where are we so far? Let's take a completely black Labrador retriever. What I need is a minimum of the following. I need to have a K that binds to E. I need to have an E that allows K to bind. I need to have a weak version of A that does not interfere with K and E. I need to have a strong version of C that allows us to move along the pathway toward the B's and D's. And then once I get to the B's and D's, I need big B to make black eumelanin pigment, and I need big D to give me full, rich, undiluted black eumelanin. I don't want to dilute that down. So what I need is all of those particular things to be in place to get a nice black Labrador retriever, if you can envision that. Notice this. Almost any variation in the pathway will result in a lack of black eumelanin and the possibility of defaulting to one of the paler pathways. So the answer to the question, how do I get a black dog? I won't say it's really straightforward, but it's pretty straightforward. I've got to have a bunch of things in place, and I just listed them. Okay. The answer to the question, how do I get a dog that's anything spot black is much more complicated. Almost anything can happen. Let me just show you a few examples. Let's say that A was the one that was causing the paler colored dog. That would just be that I had a strong version of A that prevented K from binding onto E, and that's how I'm going to get a yellow dog. That would be how I'd get a golden retriever, for example, one of the ways I could get a golden retriever. There are other ways. Or let's say that I had a weaker version of E such that K could not bind to it. We're going to get a cream-colored dog out of that. Or let's say I had almost any version of C besides the one that allowed us to head toward the B's and the D's. I'm going to get pale coat colors out of that. By the way, I keep saying pale and cream-colored and yellow. At no point have I said white yet. White is a whole different issue, and we will get to white. Right now, we're just talking about more golden, creamy versions of the melanins, roughly equivalent to blonde hair and red hair in humans, if you want to try to extrapolate to humans a little bit. Okay, so very intriguing, I hope. You see that really one major way to get black, and then just any number of ways to get the various creams and goldens, which means when dog breeders are trying to sort this out for their particular lineage of dogs, sometimes there are surprises in matings between the paler colored dogs. Sometimes things are not quite what they seem, because one dog might be a paler colored because of one particular gene that is in a certain form, and another dog might have a different gene that's causing that paler color. So to say this again, because I think, you know, repetition is important for something like this. It's challenging stuff. Another way to talk about that black Labrador retriever is to talk about its genotype. So listen as I tell you its genotype, and just hear the genotype and connect it up with what I've talked about. Its genotype is big K, big K, big E, big E, little a, we'll come back to that, big C, big B, big B, big D, big D. What's with the little a? That's the weak version of A that's going to allow K and E to bind. Okay, so it's a pretty straightforward genotype. We've got six genes in play there, and if all of them are in play, just as I said them, that's going to be a true breeding black coat color in a black Labrador retriever. Let's turn it into the possibility of a chocolate lab, though, or a brown-colored lab. So listen for the difference, okay? We're going to make a chocolate lab right now, chocolate Labrador retriever. Big K, big E, big E. Little a, big C, here's the difference. Big B, little b introduces the possibility, and then big D. It's the big B, little b that we want to zero in on, okay? Now let's do as Mendel taught us. Mendel said, look, if you know what the K's are doing, and you know what the E's are doing, and you know what the A's and the C's and the D's are doing, ignore them and just zero in on the B's, because that's where the really interesting difference is. And let's just look at those big B, little B matings and see what all happens. And sure enough, what we get is what we talked about a couple of lectures back. Big B, little B with big B, little B gives us a 3-to-1 ratio. We get three black dogs and we get one brown dog, or one chocolate colored dog. It's a good example of the brilliance of Mendel. He said, let's reduce this down to a single gene and let's understand it that way. But it's also a good example of how we need to take what Mendel taught us and put it into a much bigger context and understand it that way. Now, it turns out that that's a fairly straightforward example using the B genes. It's a little more complicated if I were to recite the genotype of a cream-colored or a yellow-colored dog. The possibilities are many. We talked about them using English words. Let me just tell you a few possibilities for pale coat color so you can get an idea and we can reinforce that idea. Again, if black is big K, big E, little a, one of the possibilities for pale coat color is we take the E's and make them little e. We say, well, we have a weak form of E, and we're not going to be able to make the full melanin pathway that way. Or big K, big E, little a, little c. There's the difference. But we are not done with dog coat color yet. Far from it. Because if you're thinking of all the dogs that you know that they are simply not reduced down to dark, and light. And in fact, so far we've really done not much more than explain some of the milder versions of coat color that you might see in humans or in some wild animals. So there's more. There's lots more. And what I want to do is return to the interactions between K and A and E, those interactions that were happening just outside of the cell. And I want you to envision something. Imagine that E, and remember I said your mnemonic aid for that is E is like a little entrance. It's like a little handle on an entrance. What if it were more like a screen door handle and that the screen door was banging, flapping open and shut? Okay? And what if K and A, and remember I said K and A are Kenny and Albert. They're fighting to grab that screen door handle or not. What if their little cycles of wins and losses were happening like little pulses? What if it was not a straightforward competition? Sometimes K was winning, sometimes A was winning. Sometimes we were actually heading up the darker pathway. Sometimes we were actually heading down the lower pathway. What might be the result of that? The result actually is fascinating. The result is that we get pulses of color. Pulses of color. To try to envision this, don't imagine the adult dog. Imagine the dog as an embryo. Imagine the dog has not yet gotten its full coloration, nowhere near. We're just talking about a few hundred or a few thousand cells in an embryonic dog. And here's where the pathway is beginning. But rather than simply laying out a beautiful rich coat of black or a rich coat of brown, K and A are having the most extraordinary interactions over E, which is banging like a screen door in the wind. And the pulses of color give us the range of two-colored dogs that include beagles and Dobermans to start with. Just envision those for a moment. Patches of lighter colors and darker colors of various sizes on the dog and in various positions on the dog. By the way, the positions of those patches of color are important, and we will talk about that in a little bit. But right now, just imagine that we've got pulses of color very early in the embryonic stage. And then, very intriguingly, what if the cycle of wins and losses between K and A were very tight? What if there was just a real tight little set of cycles such that it was not so much the entire dog that was getting colored in pulses of color, but individual hairs were getting colored with pulses of black or brown and yellowish? And that's what you get if you dare to look closely at a wolf hair or a wildcat hair, or another option is the hair of any dog that has a kind of a wild animal-like coat color, like some German shepherds. German shepherds are an example of this. And the general name for this is agouti, A-G-O-U-T-I. It actually comes from the mouse genetics or the rodent genetics people, but it applies here too. And if you look at one of the major hairs from German shepherds that have this kind of coloring, or a wolf or a wildcat, or certain cats in general that have that kind of wildcat-looking coloring, you'll see, if you look very closely, that the hairs are multicolored. And this is part of this whole complicated set of interactions between K and A that on a large scale gives us beagles and Dobermans, but on a much tighter scale gives us things like German shepherds and wildcats and that sort of things. Now, this is actually part of a very important concept. The series of alleles that can give us this range is called an allele series, and it's really about A. A seems to be the gene to watch with this particular set of traits that I'm talking about. And we talk about A as being in a series, and we talk about the phenotypes of A as being in a spectrum, using that color word spectrum, but we get to use it in a metaphorical way in just a little bit. So that you should imagine that stronger versions of A will give us different pulses of color than weaker versions of A. And we're going to have the whole spectrum all the way from beagles and Dobermans to German shepherds to dogs that are just plain yellow, or dogs that are just plain black. They're on the spectrum as well. Possibly you've heard that word spectrum used in the news when talking about certain behavioral spectrum, like the autistic spectrum, which ranges from the fairly mild condition Asperger's to maybe more less mild versions of Asperger's, all the way to the mildest versions of autism to the most extreme versions of autism. The word spectrum is being used for that. And the thing to understand about this is that we're far from sorting out what the pathway, the very complicated pathway, must look like that results in what psychologists consider to be normal human behavior, normal human interactions. But what we are seeing is that whatever that complex pathway looks like, there have got to be series of alleles in there that are giving us this spectrum of traits that gets called the autistic spectrum. So it's a wonderful metaphor for this. Now, I want to add some nuances in, because we still have not talked about some of the really specialized sorts of coat colors, such as patches of white, stripes of white, spots of white, entirely white dogs. And we also haven't talked about some of the more unusual coat colors like merle and brindle. It is typical for complex traits and mammalian coat colors, that's a complex trait, to involve more than one pathway, essentially more than one factory, the products of which are interacting in some particular way. It's also about how we define pathways. If I choose to define the pathway as something bigger than what we've just done, then maybe it's all part of one gigantic pathway. But I'm going to bring in another pathway here that's going to interact with the one that we've just dissected, the one that we've just analyzed. And it's the one that will give us some of the variations around whites and grays and some of the interesting striping patterns. So I'm going to bring in the S genes. I'm going to bring in the M genes. And I'm going to say a little bit more about the A genes, which turn out to be extremely interesting. Okay, so let's talk about white first. When I say white, I could mean an entirely white dog. I could mean a dog that is white but has got spots of various sizes and in various positions. And typically not with dogs, but with other animals, I could be talking about stripes as well. And it's okay for you to be thinking about zebras for that one, because zebras are a beautiful example of a striping pattern of black and white. What we need in order to get spots and stripes is a pathway that packages up melanin and then transports the melanin-filled cells all over the body of the developing animal. Remember, this is all happening back in the embryonic stage, that the major events are happening. So imagine an embryonic animal that does not yet have its full pigmentation. And what we need are the genes M and S to complete the picture. The genes in the series M are actually going to take the melanin, whether it's eumelanin or pheomelanin, and package it up into little discrete packages so that it will be stable in the cell. Okay, I guess the metaphor is we packaged cookies at the end of the cookie factory. Okay, so this is the packaging at the end, only it's a little bit more important than just packaging cookies, because it turns out if you don't do it right, there are all sorts of consequences. But think of it as a little packaging set of genes. And then the S genes are going to actually take those melanocytes, the entire cell, with everything all packaged up, and send it forth by the multiples, by the thousands and tens of thousands, all over the body to deposit pigment where it's going to end up, whether it's spots or stripes or whether the entire dog is going to get colored black. Okay? Again, this is one of those things that's difficult to put into a simple linear pathway. In a way, can you see that M and S are maybe more important than K, E, A, C, B, and D? I mean, if you don't package up the pigment and send it where it's going, then nothing's going to happen. This is how you get a completely white dog that, in fact, has a perfectly good big B gene and a perfectly good big D gene and good big C gene, but the pigment never went anywhere. It just stayed put. So these actually are very important genes that, in a sense, if you're going to try to put this in a linear sort of way, they're much higher at the top of the pathway, much, much more important in the whole cascade of events. What I sometimes say to my students is, it's a little bit like you loaded the car up with suitcases to go on a trip, but then you never went anywhere. And so imagine that the pigmentation has gone nowhere in the developing animal, and you could end up with a completely white animal. Now, here's a really interesting thing that I know you've observed, and finally, here's going to be the explanation. Where everything's being loaded up and getting ready to be transported out is along the backbone of the developing animal. And that's why it's along the backbone of any mammal that, if there's going to be color, is often the darkest color. And it's the underside of the animal where the pigmentation-filled cells have to travel furthest that you're likeliest to have the lighter colors. So think of any animal that you know in which there are combinations of dark and light. It's typically lower on the animal where the pigment cells have had further to go, and it's typically along the backbone where the darkest color is. Now, imagine a zebra. Think of those stripes coming down from the backbone of the zebra. What you're seeing there is an amazing function of the S genes. A little bit too complicated to get into in great detail right here, but you can get a glimpse of what's happening. You're getting dark and light patterns. Sometimes the S genes are giving us a pulse of color, a stripe down the side of the zebra, and sometimes they're not. And it's how you get stripes in cats as well. There's sort of a roughly equivalent situation, at least in terms of appearance, that you can get in dogs, but it's caused by a different phenomenon. I want to mention it because some people have brindle dogs and they might be thinking, oh, yes, okay, here's my explanation for brindle dogs. Brindle is a very interesting coat color in dogs. It can appear in just little tiny patches, or you can have an entire dog that's brindle. It's sort of a pattern of dark in yellow stripes, sometimes on kind of a miniature scale. And actually, what does that is the A gene. That's another example of A pulsing. Remember the pulse colors that give us beagle and Doberman and the wildcat fur like agouti. Actually, brindle fits in there. So brindle is not so much of a transport gene. It's a pulsing of A kind of a gene product. I wanted to do that digression just to sort that out for people who have brindle dogs. Now, let's look at the M genes that package pigment. What happens if they don't package it up quite right? Well, that's where you get into a whole realm of dog colors that sometimes get called merle or harlequin. And what's really interesting about those is that there are some consequences of being merle or harlequin, which suggests that this is part of a much bigger pathway that still needs to be sorted out. Imagine a Great Dane, because this is a coat color that Great Dane breeders seem to value, in which the big spots of black are actually relatively pale and kind of milky colored, and you've got kind of a merle or harlequin kind of color. Sometimes those dogs have one blue eye and one brown eye that goes along with this M gene. Sometimes those dogs are deaf in one ear and not the other. And then here's the amazing thing. Some double versions of Big M, Big M are lethal. So it suggests that the M series of alleles is part of a pathway that's doing a little more than just packaging up some pigment and giving us colors of some dogs. I'll say another little caveat. It is sometimes tricky to go to a dog breeder site and get really straightforward information about lethal alleles. I mean, it's a marketing thing. It's not necessarily things that people want to necessarily talk about too much if they're trying to market particular dog colors. So you have to dig a little bit deeper to actually find out more about the merle alleles if you're interested in them. Going back to the S's, there's also something very interesting with those. Remember, the S's are the alleles that are going to give us either a completely white dog, or a striped animal, or a dog with patches of black, or a dog with just a little bit of black at the top of the body and pale underneath, and all sorts of variations like that. Remember, those are the transport genes. Turns out that during development of the dog, when those pigment-filled cells are being transported all around, at the very same time, in using a very similar part of the pathway, all the neurons are also being transported. Remember, they're coming from the backbone too. There's your central nervous system. And so if you can follow what's going on with the pigment fill genes, you're also getting a little map of how the neurons traveled. And this is why the S genes, too, have some real complexities to them that seem to go far beyond pigmentation, just as the M genes are sometimes accompanied by problems with the nervous system, such as deafness. So, too, some of the S genes are accompanied by problems with particularly vision or hearing. It's a complicated, complicated picture and not fully understood, but really suggestive of really seriously pleiotropic situation that goes far beyond just pigmentation. In the next lecture, I am going to talk a little bit more about dogs and coat colors and bring in some surprising things from an amazing set of experiments that were done and that are still ongoing. And that's going to be our segue into seriously considering some of the consequences of environments, because so far we've talked about all these wonderful genes interacting and doing amazing things, but we have not yet really brought in environment. So that's what will happen in the next lecture.
This ends Lecture 5.